Welcome to Romancing the Saints with Pastor Gene Pensiero. We're glad you're joining us as we study verse by verse through books of the Bible, discovering God's extravagant love for His people. Now we pick back up in Exodus chapter 12, verses 29 through 42, in the second part of a study titled, Let Them Go, Can't Hold Them Back Anymore.
How many of you have said to yourself, how can those people even go through that? How can you even deal with that? It's at such a magnitude that it's overwhelming. And you know what? That's true. It is overwhelming. And platitudes, all things work together for good. Well, yes, they do. But in the meantime, you're crippled with grief. You're overcome by sorrow. And there's a sense in which it's not escapism to know for a fact that one day as a Christian, you're going to leave all of that behind. And there will be a place for you with no tears, no tears at all. It's almost not fathomable, but that's the perspective that you and I can have as we are passing through as pilgrims and strangers. Terrible things happen, and you know why? Because men are sinners, because this world belongs to the God of this world, the ruler of this age. God is doing everything that could possibly be done to save individuals from out of that for eternity. While he's doing that, he tolerates evil, terrible evil, tremendous evil. But in the long run, men and women, children will be saved and will inherit eternity and know eternal life. And so it's a great mindset, the pilgrim mindset. And so we need to embrace it. Now, secondly, you're to set out on your pilgrimage. Sometimes you need a kickstart to get going. I don't know if you guys follow Kickstarter, one of those crowdfunding sites where you ask for funding to kickstart your project. I always go in there and search for coffee machines. And some of them are ingenious and some of them are just really stupid. But anyway, since it launched in 2009, 12 million people have pledged $2.8 billion to fund 116,000 projects. And so, so you put your project up there, and then you say, hey, this is what I want to do. And people say, I'm going to invest in that. And usually, like if it's a coffee maker, then you get one of the first run off of the, off of the factory floor for a reduced price. And it's kind of fascinating. Of course, there are a lot of Kickstarter failures. And if they fail, you lose your money. But hey, it's only money. Now, the Israelites, why am I saying this? Because the Israelites may have invented crowdfunding. And they certainly got a kickstart from the Egyptians, so hang with me on this. Verse 33, and the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall be dead. Now God in his foreknowledge saw that the death of the firstborn would be the final sign necessary to overcome Pharaoh's reluctance. The Egyptians didn't know that, and they were thinking that if Pharaoh didn't let Israel go now, then God would start killing even more Egyptians. And so they said, hey, this has to stop right now. We can't afford to lose anything else. Their entire agricultural economy had been destroyed for maybe decades to come. And now the firstborn of every family and every animal had been killed. And so, I mean, there comes a point at which you need to overrule Pharaoh and say, hey, these people need to go. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. What? Who cares? I mean, we're in the middle of this tremendous flow of narrative, and they say, oh, by the way, they took their unleavened bread with them, wrapped up in their clothes. This is crazy, except that Moses is also establishing that as this nation is born, there is a lot going on. And there's going to be, as we saw last week, a series of festivals or feasts on the calendar, beginning with Passover, then unleavened bread, first fruits, Pentecost, and then Tabernacles ends it all. But Moses is interested in giving you more than just the story. He wants to establish that Israel is a significant nation. And we're going to see a lot of references to their unleavened dough. And later in Exodus, we're going to see all of the feasts, all seven of them, and we're going to talk again about how they were prophetic of God's plan of redemption, not just for Israel, but for the human race. And so the unleavened bread also spoke of the haste in which they left Goshen. They had no time for the dough to rise. And so the tension that's building here is that, hey, you know, we've been in bondage all these years, but now just like that, we have to leave, grab some unleavened bread, and let's go. As for the bulls, listen to this. It was customary to travel with the kneading troughs bound in clothing to keep them handy. They were small wooden bowls used to mix flour and water or milk for bread cakes. Some were made of leather and could be closed like a pocketbook. Dough was often carried in them. Pretty ingenious. And so people were always walking around with their dough so that they could make a little bit of food. Some of them were wooden and some had these cool leather pouches. I could see this pitched on TV Shark Tank as, you know, the next latest greatest product. Hey, you may have a wooden bowl, but we have a leather one with Velcro, you know, or something like that. And so it was something that every Israelite had on them. If you robbed an Israelite, you'd always get their kneading trough, you know, so something like that. No? It's kind of like, what do you, travel with something. Everybody travels with something that they can't do without. And I don't want to know what it is. Mine has to do with coffee, but, you know, a lot of cool travel coffee stuff. And now some cars you can plug, some people have cars that have like 110 outlets in them, so you can bring your whole like espresso machine with you now. Verse 35, now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So here's what I meant, crowdfunding. They were a huge crowd. They asked for these things, and people gave them to them in abundance. So it was the very first crowdfunding program. I don't like the connotation of plundered. Makes the Israelites seem like they were robbers. Like when you're being held up and you say, take everything, you know, you're under duress. I guess it could be construed that way. The Israelites were asking nicely while the Egyptians were thinking, take whatever you want before God kills more people. But I think really it's not so, they ended up plundering them in one sense, but it was given freely. In order for them to go. And some commentators have suggested that we see it as maybe deserved for back wages for their slavery. But however you look at it, they ended up with tremendous wealth. Now, just an aside here, normally we don't solicit funding for God's projects from non-believers. It's never a good idea to get money or goods or anything else from unbelievers, you know, to do the work of God. Believers should fund that. And the truth is, here at Calvary, we almost never, if ever, solicit from believers either. We don't talk to you about giving or what you should give. You're safe with your wallet here at Calvary Chapel. No, we're not after your money. However, I will say this, when we do hit the topic of money in Scripture, people always ask me, they say, hey, Gene, you know, in the New Testament, do you have to tithe? Do you have to give 10% of your income? And the answer to that, the quick answer is no. And then everybody sighs, oh, thank goodness. Oh, man, because I'd be in so much trouble if that were true. And so what is the New Testament standard for giving? Paul gives it in the Corinthian epistles. He says, first of all, it's understood that Christians give. And then he says you should give regularly. You should give joyfully, or some say hilariously. The offering should be the funniest part of the service. There goes my lunch. But anyway, so you should give regularly, you should give joyfully, and you should give sacrificially. And so somewhere between $1 and however much money you actually make is a number that God is going to talk to you personally about that hits all of those benchmarks, that it's regular, that it's joyful or hilarious, and that it's sacrificial. And that's between you and the Lord. And we trust that you have a relationship with the Lord and that he will reveal that to you. One thing that we want to talk about. So we're not looking for non-believers to fund our projects. We're looking for believers, but we're not asking you. We're just leaving that to you. In the case of the Israelites, as I said, commentators soften the plundering by suggesting the stuff deserved was a kind of back wages for them. And I guess that's a good way of looking at it. However you look at it, the Jews went out with considerable wealth, which sounds great, but wasn't a great idea when you're traveling through the desert in hostile lands without a Brinks truck. I mean, you're literally just carrying Egyptian garments and gold and silver as you wander through the desert. And there are other nations whose lands are thinking, hey, these guys are the guys that plundered the Egyptians. We don't have to rob the Egyptians. We just rob them. And as far as we know, they have no military experience. This is a easy pickings kind of a situation. And so verse 37, then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. Time to put on our math hats. We're told elsewhere that there were 603,550 men who qualified for military service. That's from the book of Numbers, chapter 1. Based on this, a conservative estimate for the total number that left, including women and children, would be in excess of 2 million people. Wow, but we're not done. Because one source suggests it was about double that, and here's the math. Men of war, these are rounded off figures. Men of war, 600,000. Wives of men of war, 600,000. Wives of others not engaged as men of war and their sisters, 400,000. Children of men of war, 2,400,000, four per family, which was a good average for the Israelites. Levites a month old and upward, 22,300. Wives of Levites 30 to 50 years old, 8,580. Wives of younger and older Levites and sisters, 2,000. Children of Levites, 34,320. Total number of Israelites, 4,067,200. But we're still not done because verse 28 says, a mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. Who were this mixed multitude? In this multitude were to be found heathens who were deeply impressed by the wonderful works of the Lord, as seen in the history of Israel, many who were tired of the despotic rule of Pharaoh, many more who were animated by curiosity and who desired to see what end this vast nation would be led. And no doubt many families who had intermarried with Israel would follow their relatives, animated by mingled feelings of love and sorrow. I'm sure, not sure how they arrived at the number, but the same source we've been quoting suggests that there were as many as 2 million in the mixed multitude. So you could have upwards of 6 million people and livestock. Quite a congregation. Here's a description of their moving column. If they went 400 abreast, there would be a line 8.7 miles long, allowing 3 feet for each of the 15,252 rows. Now, we immediately say, oh, it can't be that many people. Yes, it could. Yes, it was. This is a tremendous undertaking, the likes of which are incredible, just the logistics of it. I have a hard time making a grocery list and going to Walmart and fulfilling it. You know, I go crazy if they don't have the one item that I'm looking for. It's like, I want to find the manager. Where is the basil pesto? It's usually right here. Every week, it's right here. It's gone. I have two recipes that require basil pesto. If I can't find it, I have to go home right now and redo my shopping list and start all over again. It's terrifying. 6 million people and their livestock. Now, can you begin to appreciate why Moses needed 40 years of training as a desert shepherd? He had a tremendous flock to lead into and through the desert. And I don't know that anything can ever truly prepare you for this, but he wasn't ready at age 40 as a military leader. Being a general wasn't going to help him, but being a shepherd would. Verse 39, and they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Moses must have really liked bread. I mean, he just, hey, by the way, have I talked to you about unleavened bread in the last few minutes? Because that's what we're going to be eating for a while. It reminds me of the prophetic progress of our world today, however, the haste in which they left. Scoffers point out that the world has gone on for centuries and Jesus has not returned. I mean, I've been a Christian since 1979, And I've been saying, ready or not, Jesus is coming. I mean, that started as a bumper sticker in my rear, on my bumper. And it started off as a bumper sticker that I put on my rear window, is what I was trying to say. And I couldn't think of the name window. I mean, it just was, because I'm trying to remember if I bought basil pesto this week or not for this afternoon. But anyway, so I've been saying that since then. I mean, this has been going on for centuries. And scoffers say, where's the promise of his coming? Everything just continues just the way it always has. But you know what? When you read the book of Revelation, for example, once God pulls the trigger on something, it's on. I mean, it happens. Bam, bam, bam. And so these guys, yeah, 430 years, total, including all this last 8 months and all the waiting and waiting. And then one night says, this is it tonight, right now. Grab your unleavened bread right now. We are gone. And you know, that's what the tribulation is going to be like in the future. People watch these specials on television where maybe we can save the environment, maybe we can be better people, maybe we can live, you know, forever and avoid the apocalypse. No, because the apocalypse has nothing to do with the environment, and it does have a lot to do with becoming better people, but that only happens when you trust Christ as your Savior. And so once that starts, Jesus says it's going to happen quickly. And that means that the 7 years are going to happen in succession, bam, 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 just as he says in the book of the Revelation. And so God, he delays from one point of view, although we know that 1,000 years is like one day to the Lord. It seems to be a delay, but once he starts something, it's on. Now, this phrase, out of Egypt, is repeated 56 more times in the Bible after this point. Since Egypt is recognized as a type of the flesh, we should always be able to be described as being out of Egypt. Passover lamb was consumed, then unleavened bread was their diet, all to be commemorated in annual feasts that would pass on the knowledge of their deliverance. Verse 40, now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. It came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very day, came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. There are discussions and debates about exactly when the 430 years begin. One that makes sense is the day that God revealed to Abraham that his descendants would in fact be held captive in Egypt. It's a real number, not a guess or an estimate, because Moses wrote on that very same day to let us know it was a precise moment. It's amazing how often God does something on a specific prophesied day. The day Jesus rode into Jerusalem, that last week of his life on earth before the resurrection, was predicted to the very day by the prophet Daniel in the Old Testament. And it could have been calculated. And that's why Jesus said, you can't keep people from screaming and shouting, because if they didn't, the rocks would have to cry out, because this is that day. As we saw last week, and we'll see again in Exodus, Jesus fulfilled the first four calendar feasts of Israel in his first coming on the very day that they were being observed. When Jesus died on the cross, the Passover lambs were being slain in the temple, fulfilling that to the very day. And so God is able to do these things precisely. Verse 42, it is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. The narrative again leaves the immediate story to remind how important the annual observances would be to the life of the nation. Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, those are feasts that are going to require male Jews to travel to Jerusalem 3 times each year. Even though the Jews would finally get into the Promised Land wasn't a place where they really settled spiritually, because it was filled with enemies and fighting and those kinds of things. And even after they conquered the land, there was a pilgrimage 3 times a year from the outlying areas back to Jerusalem to remind them that they remained pilgrim wanderers, spiritually speaking. And so you may settle in, but you know, in a physical sense, but you have to have the mindset that you're a pilgrim. The earthly promised land is not a type of heaven. Nothing pertaining to this earth is home for any of God's people. As I said earlier, the Israelites left the perils of Egypt for the perils of the pilgrimage, but leave it they did. They set out, and so do we when we get saved. Perils there be, however, along the way. Some of them, if we're honest, are terrible. They cause nearly unbearable suffering and sorrow. Their effect can be crippling. Nevertheless, we must set out as pilgrims every day and embrace the truth that we're on a pilgrimage and keep our eyes set on the city whose builder and maker is God. Now, I mentioned John Bunyan. He was no stranger to a pilgrim's peril. He spent a dozen years in prison for refusing to stop preaching the gospel. And then later on in his life, he was imprisoned again. Here's a little overview of Pilgrim's Progress. Maybe you haven't read it recently, or maybe you've never read it. Christian flees from the city of destruction and makes his way through many dangers and difficulties to the celestial city. One of the first places to which Christian comes is the Slough of Despond, where he is almost swamped by doubts and fears. Almost thrown off course, the faithful evangelist directs him to the wicket gate through which he must pass to find the path to the celestial city. Going through, he comes to the house of the interpreter, who shows him many wondrous things and sends him on his way. From there, Christian ascends a hill with the cross upon it, where he loses the burden of sin from his back. He goes on up another hill called Difficulty, passes between two chained lions to a lodge where he rests and is armed for his onward journey. His arms and armor are immediately put to the test in a long and painful battle with Apollyon, where Christian wins through in the face of much distress. He meets a fellow pilgrim called Faithful. Together they press on to Vanity Fair with all of its carnality, where both of them are imprisoned and where Faithful is martyred. Christian is delivered and travels on with another friend, Hopeful, who has come to be a pilgrim through the testimony of Christian and Faithful. Although the two escape the snares of the hill Lucre, they are captured by the giant Despair through Christian's foolish going out of the way and held for a time in Doubting Castle. Again they escape, this time through the use of a key called Promise. On they travel to the Delectable Mountains, where four shepherds called Knowledge, Experience, Watchful, and Sincere care for them, give them a sight of the celestial city far ahead. Pressing on through encounters with men, including Ignorance and Atheist, they come to Enchanted Ground. To prevent themselves being made drowsy and lulled to sleep, they talk of good matter and so pass through the Enchanted Ground to the land of Beulah, to a place of rest and delight. One last obstacle awaits them before they can reach the heavenly city, a river called Death. There is no way to the celestial gate but through this river, the depth of which changes depending on the faith of those passing through it. Hopeful passes through quite easily, but Christian is at first overwhelmed with fears. Hopeful strives to keep his friend's head above the water with encouragement, and soon Christian gets a view of Christ that delivers him from his fears. The two men pass through the river to the celestial city. They are welcomed into glory. Put yourself in the story. You are Christian. Where are you on your pilgrimage? Are you in some Slough of Despond, wrestling with Apollyon, captured by giant Despair, imprisoned in Doubting Castle? Or are you settled somewhat comfortably in Vanity Fair, in a place of fleshly carnality? Maybe you're at or approaching the final river, about to pass over into the celestial city, and you are a mixture of excitement and wonder along with a little bit of trepidation. We're all somewhere on a pilgrimage, and we're all really at different places, and some of them are not so nice places. You have to understand that. I don't know. Maybe you go from here and listen to other messages that seem more hopeful. But I like to let you know that you're in, as Jesus said, in the world you would have what? Tribulation. And some of it is just, it just tears you up as you watch others go through it, as you go through it yourself. But that's what it means to be a pilgrim. You're all at different spots. You may not always be at that spot. You may be at a better spot. You may be at a worse spot. But it is a pilgrimage, and you're on your way to a city whose builder and maker is God. Read about it, Revelation 21 and 22. The best thing I can do this morning is to just greet you by saying, hello, pilgrim. Let's pray.
Pastor Gene has been serving in the Central Valley of California at Calvary Hanford since 1985. You can find hundreds more Bible studies by visiting our website at calvaryhanford.com. There you'll find video, audio, and transcripts of sermons just like the one you just heard. You can also find links to get Pastor Gene's books at calvaryhanford.com/books. We hope you'll join us next time on Romancing the Saints as we continue to discover that you are the passion of Jesus.